I want to bring you this morning the Christian love and the best wishes of Sister Megason and some others along the way who could not be here, who wanted much to be here but could not make the arrangements. As I witnessed the baptism yesterday, I think with many others, we thought of our own baptism years ago and of the years that have come into our lives since, the experiences, the fellowship, the trials, the blessings. And I thought today, those who had taken that step and any others who are thinking of that would be greatly encouraged by our study of the book of Ruth. You know that in the Dawn there are published each month the series of Sunday school lessons, as we used to call them, the Sunday Bible topics. And always since I knew the truth, I've got a great blessing, a deep knowledge of the truth, a better understanding of our Heavenly Father through a thorough study of those Sunday school lessons. And this is one of them. It came about, you know, a few Sundays ago, perhaps a month ago. And I believe while we've all read the book of Ruth, and we've all received a blessing out of it, that a deeper study than usual will give to each one of us, especially to the young people who are with us and who associate themselves with the truth people, will give to them a better understanding of what is ahead of them. That they're leaving a condition of darkness, of confusion, of a lack of everything that is worth the having, and are approaching a condition of fellowship with God's people, in which they will be prepared for the enjoyment of everything that is worth the having, and that their experiences will bring them a deeper, sweeter fellowship with their God, a better understanding of His mind, of His language, of His methods of doing things, and of His word. And I believe as the days grow on, you will find that while trials will come, because they are part of the lessons, we wouldn't want to be without them, that nevertheless, to more than compensate them, there will be fellowship with the Lord. There'll be experiences when you will be given privileges that will grow deeper and richer as the years go by, in which you will feel glad that you made that step, and will feel that the years before your consecration period are lost years, except in the way of experience. It has been sometimes expressed that for the joy that is set before us, looking to the resurrection morning. But don't forget that Jesus said, there is no man that hath left houses or lands or wife or children or family for my sake and the gospel's, but shall receive now in this present life 100-fold. And in the world to come, everlasting life. Do you believe that? I have found it to be the fact that the Lord does give us now things that are 100-fold more valuable. And also, literally it is speaking, that for instance, if you gave up one home, you find that you're welcome in more than 100. And that if you gave up one thing, the Lord has put you in position to enjoy the use of many things that more than compensate for it. So let us look into the book of Ruth a little more deeply. We'll find therein that love of God that surrounds His people continually, that reaches out when we don't know it, even when we stray away from Him for a while. That love reaches out and while we're away, prepares the road backward, and the reception and the blessings there. Let us look into the book. It came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. Now that was the period of 450 years in which there was no king. There was no ruler that could compel the people to do this or that or the other. There were no policemen to put fear into the minds of wayward hearts. Every man did what he believed was right before God and his fellow men. That condition existed for 4.5 centuries. This country has existed for somewhat less than 200 years. Do you think now we could withdraw all the policemen and there would be peace and security in this land? We're not that moral and strong yet. We need the presence of police all over the land to compel obedience. But here in Israel, often it happened that they were nearer God and had a higher moral standard than we do even now in our beloved country. Separations and divorce and family troubles are becoming so longer that they're not even a disgrace anymore. That's a bad condition. So the judges ruled and every man did what was right. It was in that time when the tribe of Dan became dissatisfied with its inheritance and with the prospect of troubles or further struggles ahead to occupy the rest of it. And they pulled out and entered into a land to the north of them and took somebody else's possession and began to raise bulls. There is quite a bit of interest in the tribe of Dan if you look it up in the Bible. And during this period there was a famine in the land. Now the Lord, in his covenant with them, had told them that if they would be obedient, he would bless them in basket and store, in body, in land, that the rain would come as it should, and that they would have plenty, and that they would be protected from their enemies round about. But if they were disobedient, as a faithful God, he would have to punish them. He would have to do something to bring them to their senses, to wake them up, to give them a jolt if necessary. And so this famine had come as a chastisement. Now the apostle tells us in the New Testament that those whom God receives, he chastens, he gives stripes to every one whom he receiveth. Now it's the sons, the house of sons he's dealing with. But with all his experiences in the past, Isaiah tells us it was the same then, that in all their affliction he was afflicted. Think of that. God bears your difficulties with you. You're not bearing them alone. In all their afflictions he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and in his pity he redeemed them, and he bore them and carried them all the days of old. Yes, God is the God of enduring love and constancy and understanding. But there was one family that rebelled against this treatment. They did become faint-hearted. And Elimelech and his family moved out of the land of promise, away from the covenant people, into a heathen land where idols were worshipped and immorality surrounded them. Now the name of Elimelech means God is my king. It wasn't so very long before this that Eglon, the king of Moab, had conquered Israel because they were disobedient and oppressed them for 18 years. 18 long years of oppression in which they suffered a great deal. During that period, Ehud delivered them, and they learned that God was their king and was looking after their interests even when they were disobedient. This man was a man of Bethlehem, Judah. His wife was named Naomi. Naomi means pleasant, lovely. And her character turns out to be like that. But it was a well-chosen name. It is said of him that he was a man of Bethlehem, Judah, and that he was an Ephrathite. Now, these are interesting items. The very word of Bethlehem, the very name, means house of bread. The locality was very well watered and very a fruitful section of the country. It produced pomegranates and grapes, figs, and grains of various sorts in abundance. The Lord blessed that land till it was called the House of Bread. Now, the ancient name of it was Ephrath. And Ephrath means bearing in the sense of fruit bearing. Its root is the same as the ancient name of the Euphrates, Phrat. And for the same reason, meant fruitful. So this region was specially blessed of the Lord, and the famine must have been very severe to be felt even here. But this man took his wife and his two sons. The sons' names were Mahlon and Chilion. Mahlon meant a circle, dance circle in Hebrew, and hence represented joy, happiness. And Chilion was from a root that had various meanings, mainly about the point of ornament or crown. Ornament or crown. Well, these decided they would go out of this land into the land of Moab. And it wasn't very long before, after they went there, that Elimelech died. That's the statement. Elimelech died. God did not bless their going. The father, who feared he could not live in Bethlehem during the famine, hardly had reached Moab ere he died. Instead of crying and trusting to God in Bethlehem, they go to a land of idol worship. They sought to avoid one affliction, and they fell into a worse one. They sought to escape famine, but death overtook them. They did not trust God's love at home, so his judgment smote them in a foreign land. But even then, Mahlon and Chilion did not decide to go home. No, they'd evidently determined that they would not go back until the famine was ended. In violation of the law of their covenant, they took them heathen wives. And the Lord said they should not. In fact, it forbade the Moabite to enter into the congregation of the children of Israel, even unto the tenth generation, because they had ill-treated Israel on their journey thither. Now, the law particularly referred to the men who were marrying wives and founding houses, although it also forbade them to marry either way. But these sons founded their houses in the land of Moab, and Moab became their grave. They migrated to secure greater abundance, greater security. But now the widow had no husband, no sons, no property. She and the two daughters-in-law were alone in a foreign land. What should they do now? They heard that God had visited Israel, that the famine was over. And so Naomi turned her eyes, her heart, and her whole being toward her native land. It may very well be that Naomi never was fully in sympathy with their going out, but as an obedient wife, she went. You know, sometimes that's part of our duty. to give to those whom we know are taking wrong steps, nevertheless that they are determined to give them their rights. God doesn't want us to take the rights of others and offer them upon his altar. He says that is objectionable to him, an irritation in his nostrils. I remember, some of you may remember, Brother Pearson of Connecticut, who gave so freely over $1 million to the photodrama. His family were not in harmony with the truth, but he saw to it that they had all they wanted. Their provisions were taken care of. They were privileged to go with his help to places they wanted to go, although he couldn't go with him. He did his duty by it. He would not take their rights and sacrifice them to the Lord. And the Lord blessed him greatly. So then they turned their hearts toward home. Now Naomi felt that her daughters, that had been brought up in Moab, had life before them. They were young and healthy. That it'd be asking too much for them to sacrifice all their prospects and go with her to a foreign land in which they'd be strangers. And so she asked them, she urged them to return to their land, to their mother's house, because they would have before them other opportunities. And she said to them, Jehovah grant that ye may find a resting place in the home of a husband. Jehovah deal kindly with you as you have done with the dead and with me. Jehovah grant. That was customary among the children of Israel even more than now. Jehovah was the background and the mainstay of their life, their covenant, all centered around him. A scene of unequal tenderness and beauty is being enacted here as we read this story. They said, no, for we will surely return with thee to thy people. What had produced such a self-sacrificing love as that? It was an honor to the dead son that they had chosen girls like these to be their wives. They were evidently above the ordinary. And they must have been somewhat worthy of the love they awakened in their hearts, or else they wouldn't have stayed. But while the family had moved out of Israel, they had not become Moabites. They kept their faith in a heathen land. For 10 years, these had married life together. These two girls had entered an Israelite family. They'd breathed its good atmosphere. Marriage and family life are really the real mirror of religion and of worship. Israel had distinguished itself not merely by the name of its God, but by its life at home in the family. By faithfulness to wife and child. There were no children in this family, but that was the general practice. It was probably customary also for morning and evening prayer to be held. The level of morality is greater then, at that time, than even in our own land. But purity and morality in marriage were the natural and necessary results in the faith in the only living God. They saw the contrast of such a home with the life of unchaste and sensual pleasure that accompanied the idolatry of Moab. These two women were attracted gratefully to the home life of Israel. They requited the kind, tender treatment they had received with a self-sacrificing love. They heard the religion of Jehovah confessed in Moab, but more, they saw it lived in the home. And what they did and what they're ready to do are the results of that. I would want to bring in here some lessons for us. Do we, as Christian ambassadors of the Lord, so live and behave in our daily life that others who watch will be drawn to God? You have a little bookmark downstairs that says, printed on it, that we are the only Bible the poor world can read. And the only Bible they're willing to read at first. Do we strive to let the love light of God's Holy Spirit shine out in our lives so as to draw some to investigate our God? That is what we're here for. But I know that all of us, like myself, are so affected by the fallen humanity and forgetfulness that we do not let the light shine as we should. Let us resolve from this time forward that we will be more living epistles, as Paul writes to some in his day in the early church. Living epistles read and known of all men. That was in the message to the Corinthians. And then he told Timothy that he should be an example of the believers. And we are told that we are, as in the world, as lights that shine in their darkness. Let us so live then, at home and in our work, that others may see that it pays to be a Christian, that there's something worthwhile in it. You don't have to say a word, your actions will tell. And if in those actions, as times and places anew come up to you, you send up a prayer to your Heavenly Father for help and guidance in the situation, you'll be keeping in close fellowship with God, and He will give you that guidance. And what's more, that very association will bring you into deeper, sweeter fellowship with Him. You'll have a better understanding of God. Not only of His character, I don't mean knowledge. Knowledge is valuable, but knowledge is not understanding. Understanding comes with a deep experience in the application of knowledge. In Jeremiah 9:23 and 24, he says there, "Let not the rich man glory in his riches, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, let not the mighty man glory in his might. But let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me. That I am Jehovah, delight in justice and judgment." You see, understanding and knowledge are two different things. You can know a great deal and yet not be an understanding being. So let us have that, and we gain it only by experience. You cannot gain understanding any other way. You can study, you can associate, and you can think all you wish, but it will not bring you understanding, which involves the use of tact and a knowledge of how the other person feels. It takes experience. Well, there is this beautiful thought here in Naomi's wish for her daughters. She said, "Jehovah grant you a resting place in a husband that you may find in your land." The word that is here translated resting place in the Hebrew is the word menucha. In Deuteronomy, they are told, and if you wish to look it up, Deuteronomy 12:9, "Hitherto ye have not come into the rest, the menucha, and inheritance that Jehovah your God giveth you, He was referring to the land of promise into which they had not yet entered. Solomon first was the one who could give praise for the complete Menucha, the complete resting place, as a gift. In 1 Kings 8:56, he mentioned that. And the Holy Land, when possessed in faith and obedience, was the earthly Menucha to which Israel had come as the bride to the house of her husband, the promised land of rest and security, the covenant land, Israel's home. It is true that Israel's highest Menucha, it was their God, Jehovah, himself and his covenant. The world's final Menucha, or resting place, their home, is mentioned in Isaiah 11:10. In that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his resting place shall be glorious. The world doesn't believe that yet, but God has for them, for the world even, more than human heart can understand now, of glory and beauty and happiness on this earth. And for those who trust him now in the midst of evil and sorrow around them, he has things that have not entered into the human heart nor mind, which cannot be described in human language. Things that involve the joys and the power of appreciation of the divine nature. Oh, friends, if we could realize what a God we have, a God whose delight is that we should enter into as much enjoyment and happiness as is possible for us. But we have to learn lessons of self-control, of trustworthiness, to be able to handle those privileges. Men are realizing now with the atom bomb that God has placed in this earth things that compel righteousness, that those things cannot be trusted in the hands of those who do not have self-control and respect and love for their God and their fellow men. You see, the very situation is compelling mankind to come to God for relief and guidance. More than this, Jesus told us in his day to men throughout the gospel age, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart, and ye shall find a resting place unto your souls." The Greek word is anapausin. It comes from two parts, ana meaning up, and pao to stop or cease. And it means a place. Why you stop up or rest up for a while. In other words, it's the same as the Hebrew Menucha, a resting place wherein there is security, confidence, mutual helpfulness and understanding. In other words, a home for the soul. I never got that thought out of that text as many times as I've read it over, till the wife and I studied this book of Ruth. It is wonderful how God's Old Testament unfolds the new, and how the new unfolds the old. It is again an increasing evidence that it is God's message to those who want to love him, who want to be his people. And then there's another interesting point here. When Naomi saw that both of his daughters were determined to go with her, she told them, "I'm too old to have an husband, and even if I should have, this night and bear children, would you shut yourselves up?" You look in the margin, and that's what that word wait means. To shut yourselves up, to hope, to wait. Until they be grown up, would they do that? That would be a long time. She had told them that it was vain for them to hope for an husband and a home in Israel, because the things which her sons had done were against the law and the covenant of Israel. When Orpah heard that there was nothing for her in Israel as a home or a husband, she turned back. Orpah means a hind or deer, kind of antelope. She had love for Naomi. She was willing to give up her people, her home in Moab, prospects that were young there. But when it meant the final giving up of all of them, it was too much. She counted the cost and decided that she could not give that much. Here she represents many who during the gospel age hear the gospel. They love the Lord. They love truth. They want to do right. But the cost is too great. What's the trouble? Lack of faith. Lack of faith. They somehow don't look beyond the present. Would ye shut yourselves up and wait for these? Now in this word, shut up here, that is mentioned, there is a gem of thought from the Almighty. One of those things that you get by studying over and over again a thing and looking for all the helps you can get about that particular point. It does not occur, this word does not occur elsewhere in Hebrew Scripture. They find the meaning of it by association with the use of it in later Hebrew. But it is connected with the word for garden, the word which in the New Testament is given by the Greek paradisos. And it means a walled place, an enclosed or hedged condition. The word kala in Hebrew, the word for bride, or as a daughter-in-law, in Matthew 10:36, the Greek word nymphe is used. It is customary that the bride covered herself with a veil, withdrew from public view, and shut herself up. Now you remember in the Song of Solomon, the fifth chapter and fourth verse, it says, a garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Isn't that a beautiful thought? Not forever, but unto perfection, so that from this enclosed condition could grow a greater expansion of love and blessing than was possible without it. So the bride, the church, is shut up from all earthly things, from the noise and clamor of the world, waiting for her bridegroom. And it is good for her to be so shut up, so lacking in distraction of mind and heart, that she might prepare herself most completely for her husband. What is it all for? That in the resurrection morning, that my children come. Not merely a few, but in Isaiah 49 it tells us that those of the consecrated who have given their children to the Lord, as would be natural, shall not only receive those children back in the resurrection morning, but likewise the whole of mankind as their children. It pays to give up for the Lord's sake. He not only gives you back as good, but a great deal more. So that this word represents a shutting in. The Hebrew thought for a bride derives that Hebrew word from a garland that surrounded the bride and the bridegroom together. It had the thought of a shutting up, but it was by flowers, and a shutting up to perfection. To coronation, ultimately. So we see there are beautiful thoughts in the very words that the prophets and the apostles use. God's inspiration has more to it than appears on the surface. I wonder sometimes why it is that some get dissatisfied with the truth and want to nibble on external things and get tripped up by some of the adversary's deceptions. It seems that it must be that they don't study the truth, that they don't eat the food that God has placed on the table before them. Here at this convention, we have had a wonderful variety. We have had doctrinal, we have had the tabernacle, we have had various character buildings, warnings, and help. And the Lord has, by that very method, crystallized our understanding and our determination to stand firm and solidly for the truth, to be kind to others, to help them where we could, but to make it plain and evident that we believe this and we don't want error mixed up with it. We want the pure truth. The prophet Jeremiah was told by the Lord, if thou shalt take the precious from the vial, then thou shalt be my mouthpiece. We want to have that, not only ability, but action. But love, Ruth's love, was deeper. Now the name Ruth is derived by some commentators from a Hebrew word that means rose. In the other languages, the verb is very similar. The Greek word is phronon, the Latin is rosa, and this commentary quoted the Sanskrit and pointed out that even that was similar to the Hebrew word and our word for rose, evidently made from the red color of the flower. But we can think hereafter of Ruth as the rose of Moab. Jewish tradition said that she was the daughter of King Eglon. But whether that be a fact or no, she had a wonderful character possibility. She was a very fine girl. Now Ruth's love, as I said, was deeper than that of Naomi. Naomi's loving, sunny, self-sacrificing disposition had awakened and inspired a similar self-sacrificing love in Ruth. And notice that in her statement, Jehovah do so and more to me, that unconsciously her mind and heart has turned and accepted Jehovah. She uses the name of the God of Israel, not of the gods of Moab. Jehovah do more to me and so forth, if I leave thee. This gratitude expressed itself in the willingness to share whatever Naomi might experience. Poverty, loneliness, no matter what. Naomi had made Israel and Israel's God lovely in the eyes of Ruth. She wished to go to a people whose sole representatives were so amiable as this family. A God and a people who could produce such a family as this must be a lovely God also. So she is willing to give up the prospects at home for a family and a husband and all the heart's joys that might have been hers. Her love was that which reached down to the depth of her being. And she is like the Gentiles here that become Christians. During the Gospel Age, they too find they must sacrifice the earthly ambitions and hopes to become God's people. Such is consecration. God, in His wisdom, brings us down in humility to realize that we have nothing, that we must come to Jehovah with the idea that we are not worthy of His love and of His care. But that our hope is through our confidence in His promises, in through Christ. And we find that while we enter as poor in spirit, God is even better to us than He was to Ruth. Far greater. So we find that Ruth and Naomi went together. These two went. It was a sad homecoming for Naomi. Here she had gone out of the land 10 years before with plenty, with health, with husband and sons, prosperous, and now she came back. And notice what she said. So they too went, till they came to Bethlehem. And it came to pass when they were come that the whole city was moved, and they said, Is this Naomi? Is this the lovely, pleasant one that left us 10 years before? And they looked at her and asked, Is this Naomi? After their curiosity was satisfied, they didn't help. They just went back to their own business and left Ruth and Naomi alone. But God didn't leave them alone. God's love had been working for them even while they were in that heathen land. It was through him that their losses had come. Sometimes the Lord uses chastisement and loss to bring us back to him. And she said, The Lord hath testified against me. The Almighty hath afflicted me. And notice there, the Almighty hath dealt very bitterly with me. Now in this connection, it was true. She said that she had gone out full, and the Lord Jehovah hath brought me home again empty. Yes, it was Jehovah who had brought her home again. It was that sympathetic, understanding love of the Lord that had followed them even into the land of Moab. And while they were there, was preparing for them a blessing when they should come back. She gave Naomi a blessing and a comfort, didn't leave her comfortless in the presence of Ruth, her daughter, a love that was very precious. And as they went homeward, that love and the possessions that were left, those two alone together, each other, blossomed out into a joy and a happiness that they hadn't dared to dream of before. It is a fact, as you look at Ruth and her history, that she gave up a land and a people. And God brought her into the land of promise, the covenant land that had his special care above all others. She gave up a people that were strangers to God. The Lord enrolled her name in the covenant people over whom God watched day and night for their good. She had given up her husband. The Lord gave her a prince in Israel. Not only an Israelite, but a wonderful man of God. She had given up children. And their God Jehovah made her the mother of kings. And the Messiah, evidently. And if you can think of what Jehovah did for Ruth, beyond her imagination or her dreams, remember that God is going to do even more for those who trust him now. We can't enter into the wonders that are there, but it is the testimony and experience of those who have come along the way that what God gives you now is a foretaste of the future. Is beyond your dreams, beyond your capacity to know and understand now. The Apostle Paul says that in the ages to come, he will show forth the exceeding riches of his grace. Grace would be enough. Riches of grace is more. Exceeding riches of grace is almost incomprehensible. In the ages to come, in his kindness toward us through Christ Jesus. And so we would urge every young person here that the wisest thing they could do is to consecrate to the Lord and then trust him. because he will do for you far more than you could get done yourself. And even if it should turn out that you were never spirit begotten, but went on and waited for the world, you will be that much in advance of the world. You'll know your God better. You'll have a better fellowship with him, because that very consecration will give you a prayer privilege and a communion that the world doesn't have. So as the wise man said, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. Now, I wish there were more time to give you some of the thoughts that are found in the latter part of this story. It turns out that as they came into the land, that as they had nothing, Ruth volunteered to go and glean in the various fields around them. But again, Jehovah directed her steps. And amongst all the fields where she could have gone, she went into the field of Boaz and began to glean. And she gleaned like one who was earnest and sincere. She didn't spend the time in looking around and jollying with the others and being very careless. She knew what she came there to do. She loved Naomi, and she was going to gather all the wheat she could, all the grain. Boaz came from the field, from Bethlehem into the field. Now the name Boaz means in it is strength, or a son of strength, or enduring vigor. The same thoughts in all of those. It was the name of one of the pillars, you remember, in Solomon's temple. And it goes on to tell us about how Boaz noticed her, because she was not frivolous like the rest of the maids might be, but was in earnest, and her very demeanor attracted him. So he called her to him, or went over to speak to her, and said, my daughter, continue gleaning in this field. Go not elsewhere in other fields. For I have commanded the helpers that they molest you not, nor in any way hurt you, but come closer to my maidens. Now they were in the fields, the ones who reaped the grain, and then behind them went the young maidens who bound the grain in bundles. And he gave the direction to these maidens to just, without seeming to notice it, drop a little more, a whole handful for Ruth so that she could pick it up and her gleaning might be profitable. Now it was according to law in the land of Israel that any stranger or poor person had the right to glean. They had that right. And the gleaners and the owners of the fields were told not to clear them completely, not to pick all the grapes or all the pomegranates or to glean all the wheat or barley, but to leave some in the corners for the poor. That was their right. So Boaz couldn't interfere with her. And notice the majesty, the very manliness of his character. He didn't even suggest helping her too ostentatiously or too abundantly, lest it might injure her own self-respect. He respected her because she evidenced self-respect in her very demeanor. And so at noontime he asked her to come up and sit with the other helpers and eat. And he saw to it that they were passed to her morsels of parched corn. And also she was to drink the sour wine that they had, which is very invigorating and helpful. He did what he could. And then when she went back, she went like one who had not been too greatly elevated by the honors, by this blessing. And she had said to Boaz, who am I that you've taken special notice of me? And he said, I have heard what your love has done for Naomi, how you left your people and your land and what might be your prospects there, and to come to dwell in a land where you know not the people. And he gave a beautiful expression there. It's one of the loveliest in any language. He said, Jehovah grant thee a full reward, under whose wings thou art come to trust. That's what consecration does. You come to trust under the wings, the protecting power and influence of Jehovah. You don't know what a good step you're taking, But Jehovah will bless you and will give you an abundant and full reward if you'll just, as Ruth did, stay with him. Well, she indicated, you see, that she was just as serious as before. And when evening came, she shook it out and she had quite a large amount, almost an ephah of barley, something like 3.5 pecks. And she took that to Naomi. And here we have to close. But I'll tell you, dear friends, that you'll find in Boaz's action the illustration of a character that realized he was an ambassador of Jehovah too. And the action of Ruth might seem in these modern days to be something a little too wild, going a little too far. But it was an action that under the law she was privileged to take. She was calling Boaz's attention to his duty to her, according to the law. And you remember he went and accomplished that duty. But our lesson here, as it were, there's two whole studies inside this book. And as you go home, I hope you'll dig into it more and realize that the book of Ruth is one of the most comforting messages to God's people. That it tells you of that friend that sticketh closer than a brother. And also of that love that we used to sing about, oh, love that will not let me go. You see, Jehovah's love is an enduring love. And he reaches out to help you when you stumble, even when you go astray for a while. That compelling love will arrange circumstances to bring you back again. For after all, it is a life and death matter with you. And so may the Lord bless this study. I hope it has brought to you some jewels of thought that you can carry home and study God's word with a deeper determination and in knowledge that you're going to get always some jewels of thought from God's mind. Thank you.